Let's discuss this. Let's discuss what's going on over here. I have over here a safer. One second. Let me just put this on the... Okay. I have here this safer called Pharaoh, Biblical History, Egypt, and the Missing Millennium. Okay, this is written by Alexander Houle. H-O-O-L.
He said he took anything from Abba Eben's book, the Apocrypha, of course.
No.
Abba Eben went into great detail in that book about the missing 200 years of Egyptian history.
200 years? He has 1,000 years, yes.
The Jews never were in Mitzrayim, according, but they just left it out. There's a lapse of time periods. Like you give a resume, and just a few years, there's a gap.
Okay, let's go with this. This person, his name is Alexander Houle. He lived in Panovich. He grew up, I think his father was a Rav, if I'm not mistaken, maybe not, I'm a little confused. He grew up in London, in the United Kingdom, and he is a Talmud Chacham beyond belief. In addition to being a Talmud Chacham beyond belief, he's a mathematician. He just plain simple a genius. Genius of geniuses. He published a number of books, a number of Sfarim, on all different topics. A lot of the topics he published on science and history, and a lot of his work involves mathematics, some very sophisticated calculations. The Sefer is literally breathtaking, and there's no way I can even scratch the surface of understanding what it says. I can't even pronounce probably 80% of the words that appear in this book. I'm not even going to try to say the names of some of the dynasties, some of the things that he has here. And let me just try to give you a little bit of a gist of what he does in this Sefer. And at the end of the Sefer, he has the appendices, he has chidushim, just stam chidushim on the parsha, on this week's parsha, next week's parsha, last week's parsha, that are absolutely mind-boggling. Based upon that, just come out of the Sefer. Now, the basic idea of this Sefer is it touches upon many, many different kinds of things that go on in this world, in Judaism, in history, in anti-Semitism. It touches upon so many things. And obviously, to really appreciate this book, you have to probably spend many, many courses in fully understanding the way, the background to understand this Sefer is to first understand the way ancient Egyptian history is taught and understood in the entire world. If you go take a course in college on the ancient civilization of Egypt, Egyptology, the history of Egypt, they will all tell you that Egypt existed approximately the ancient Egypt that we know from Tanakh existed for 3,000 years. That is what you're going to hear if you go on YouTube, watch a YouTube video, or go take a course in college, or go to the library and take on any book on the history of Egypt. They will tell you, we know as a fact, it's been studied by the greatest experts in the world, and we have all the proofs with carbon dating and the artifacts and the archaeology. And the biggest world experts have concluded, trust the science. If you don't trust the science, you're not bekeres, and you just don't deserve to exist. The world will tell you there were 3,000 years of ancient Egyptian history. And they will present you the conventional chronology. You see on this piece of paper over here, the chronology, everything happened in order. This modern people from, I don't know, this goes back already probably a few hundred years. You know exactly. And they've broken up the dynasties into approximately 26, there are more, they write up 26 dynasties. This takes the first dynasty, dynasty 1-3, begins according to 3000 BCE. Okay, so 3000 BCE is about 5,000 years ago. Okay, 3000.
Well, 3760 is zero. I mean, 3760 is year one in England.
3760, so 700 years after creation,
right,
is when Egypt began, according to the Chachamim of the world. Okay, the Chachmei Umos Olam will tell you Egypt began approximately 700 years after creation. Now, when did the Malbol take place, by the way?
So basically,
right off the bat, they deny what it says in the Torah, because nothing could have possibly happened until the Malbol. And the Malbol, what year did the Malbol take place?
1656.
So which is about 800 years. 800 years, so they hold that Egypt, as they know it, they can prove from carbon dating, took place, began to be establish itself as a world power, as a nation, as whatever it was then.
From
800 years before the Malbol began. That's impossible, because the whole world basically started fresh after the Malbol, which is 1,700 years after creation, whatever, give or take, approximately that. So right off the bat, when you listen to a secular analysis of ancient Egyptian history, the first thing that you hear is apikorsis.
Right.
This is what they understand. They take all of what they have done basically is there's not so much information in what really happened. It's all based on digging up artifacts and dating them with carbon dating. And there are some, I don't know how to even pronounce all these words, there are some like monuments which have names of kings. Egypt themselves...
They have all those, but a lot of them are more recent.
Okay, we're going to discuss this. So, but even the ones that are more recent, Egypt was into keeping records. So every so often they would put up, I don't know how to pronounce all these words, and these all different types of monuments. They would etch in stone, steel? What is it called?
Steel.
Okay, I don't know. They're all different types. There are pyramids. You know, in the pyramids, there are different.
Well, each pyramid is a tomb. That's what it is.
Okay, so there are a lot of different things, and the Egyptians were in the business of keeping records, and they did proudly display in different areas, different. Egypt was a very large country, in different locations. It's come to light. I'm just going to use some words because I don't know how to pronounce these words. My ignorance is extremely great. They've come across different monuments where things have been etched in stone with different languages. I mean, like what kind of language? Hieroglyphics, which indicate, according to the best that we understand, they indicate who their own history. Who was the first king? Who was the second king? Who was the third king? Now, the way it's divided is in dynasties. And a dynasty basically means a ben, achar ben, achar ben. You have a father, a son, a grandson, a great-grandson, and then one day there's some type of rebellion and the country decides to get rid of the family. This family is no good. We're going to start with a new family. And that family, the father, the son, the grandson, the nephew, the cousin, and there comes a certain point in time, enough of this family already. Get rid of him. New family. Every time there's a new family, it's called a new dynasty. But a dynasty can last for 200 years, for 300 years. Some of them are very short, can last for 20 years, for 50 years, for 30 years. It's like you imagine today, could you imagine that you would elect a president, and that president stays in office until there's no successor from his own children. After Biden comes Hunter. After Hunter comes the Mamza. Where Machol understands this. I don't know if everyone understands all the intricacies. Okay? So we go down the line, and then when there's no one left that's right to be the Melech, elections, new elections, a new dynasty. Okay, that's the way it worked in Egypt. They had a family.
The priests selected, I mean, they were the ones who controlled
the new dynasty. There was some wars, it seems. There was some rebellion, whatever it is.
That's why the Hittites ruled for a long time. That's why Pharaoh in the time of Yosef was so concerned about assassination attempts, why he reacted so vehemently against the Saramashka and the Saraopa, because they were trying to kill him.
Okay. So we have over here, on the left side, 26 dynasties.
Yeah.
And these 26 dynasties basically date from 3000 BCE until 525 BCE, which is about, this really, over here it only stops at 26, it really is 30. So basically it's giving you 2,500 years. Plus there was more, it really went on more. When did Egypt really come to an end? Nebuchadnezzar. In the time of the Churban Bayis Rishon, that period, that era, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babel, destroyed Egypt. He wiped them out. There was no more Egypt anymore. Today there's an Egypt, you know, today there's an Egypt, they come to the...
Cleopatra was much later.
Ancient, I'm talking about the ancient Egypt. We're talking about the dynasties, we're talking about the ancient, it's a new Egypt. After about... Today, you don't hear anyone today, oh, go today, which dynasty are they up to in Egypt? What's a dynasty? Whoever heard of this? The dynasty, we're talking about... I don't even know what I'm saying. I'm just trying to summarize...
There were pharaohs in the Common Era.
That was the Ptolemy.
Okay, I'm not arguing with that. I don't know. I'm thoroughly ignorant. I'm just basically relaying what it says over here. You have to read the book, and you have to study. This is something you can read. This is extremely dense, and every paragraph requires Hakdama to go on YouTube and to learn about what he's talking about, to get the background, to hear the Chiddush. It's extremely dense and complicated. But basically, the way he explains it is that even amongst the Goyim, who study ancient Egypt came to an end with their traditions and their legacy and their worshipping of the pharaohs and all the Minhagim. It came to an end at the time of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar sacked Egypt, destroyed the whole place. He killed everyone, he destroyed the place, he took it over. Okay, so they made a comeback. The comeback, it's a new world, a new generation, a new world. They don't have the same values. They don't, yeah, it's... Nebuchadnezzar was 586. 586, fine. Okay, let's work with that. So we're dealing with, you take a course in a college with ancient history, they're going to teach history of Egypt for approximately 3,000 years. Starting in the year 3000 BCE. Okay. 2,500, over here on this chart it shows you 2,500 years.
From 3,500.
No, 3,000 to 525.
Oh, 525 is also BC.
The last one on the bottom is 525.
Right,
so that's 2500. So that's approximately 2,500 years, a little bit less, 2,525 years.
What's the name of this
Pharaoh, Alexander Hull, Pharaoh.
Pharaoh by who?
Alexander Hull.
Whom?
Hull, H-O-O-L, Hull. He learned in Panovich. He learned in Panovich for, I think, 20 years. Panovich, not Chaim Berlin, Panovich. This guy's the real deal. He's a genius, beyond belief. But let me try to explain what's going on over here. Okay, on the left side, you're going to see the conventional chronology of ancient. You take a course, they're going to tell you Egypt, the old Egypt, the old-fashioned Egypt that we know of with the pharaohs and the pyramids and all the bells and whistles. It all started out as some type of clan or tribe back in the day in 3000 BCE. And how long did it last? It lasted for about close to 3,000 years.
What year did we leave Egypt?
Oh, we're getting to that. So I'm not going to even try to go to tell you too many details because I'm going to make a fool out of myself. This is way over my head. But it really made an impression on me, and I really have a desire to read this 10 times and do a lot of I don't have time to do this. YouTube's
left Egypt in 312
BC. There's an enormous amount of information here, beyond belief. I can't even scratch the surface of understanding. Forget about trying to give. I just want to give you a gist of what I took out of this and encourage you to spend the time to figure this out on your own. But let me try to present you the idea. And he touches upon something which is truly amazing. And this is the way they present it. This is the way they present it on the left side, the conventional chronology. There's dynasty 1 to 3, which lasted for 400 years. from the year 3000 BCE to the year 2600, 400 years. And then there was dynasties 4 and 6, which these dynasties 4 to 6, by the way, according to him, at the end of the story, is the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, which is impossible according to the Goyim, totally way off. But this is how they 4 to 6, then there's 7 to 10. Okay, again, a dynasty is a family, and that includes father, son, or even to a nephew or a grandson. Like, we understand it's Birusha. Came a point in time where there was no one left in that family due to corruption, due to war, due to illness, whatever it is. So then there was a new dynasty, a new family. Each dynasty could have multiple kings, and a lot of the names, everything that the Goyim have today and the way that it's presented in the secular world is all based on evidence. It's all based on inscriptions in either hieroglyphics or, I don't know, other symbols of where the Egyptians themselves recorded their history. They recorded in their capital. There are different, the capital of Egypt always kept on changing from place to place. We'll discuss that in a few moments. And there are all different types of things etched on stone. There's evidence of artifacts, and there is continuous archaeological discoveries and understanding, and it's all this. There is a narrative, and there is an agenda and a narrative. It's been established, and you don't deviate, you don't challenge the narrative. And the narrative is, it's already been established, 3,000 years of Egyptian history, or close to that, of the ancient Egyptian history, and we basically know where everything is on the timeline, and everything that we're going to discover now is going to fit into that narrative.
Is there any, before the marbles, is there anything archaeological that they discovered?
I don't know the answer. I have no idea. They do find things. They definitely do find things. I don't know how they interpret it. I don't know. I really don't know. I can't make believe. What?
The marble explains.
Okay, right. Everything is a theory. Look, the Tiferes Yisrael says this is not the first Gilgal of this world. But Hashem already recycled this world multiple times.
Right.
It's a Medrash. Hashem created this world, and he had different types of creatures. Did not give him any Nachas Ruach. He destroyed them. And this earth, where it's recycled, we're living on a recycled planet. It was used already for other creations of Hashem before.
Well, that's how the Malbim explains it. But he says, unfortunately, what happened was the reason we put age on it is because the marble sucked up the bones toward closer to the surface from the dinosaurs, and therefore we give incorrect dating on dinosaur bones, because it really should be thousands of feet down. Well, we couldn't get to it. It's the chomer from the earth is recycled carbon.
Even carbon dating, even though it seems to be very accurate up to a certain point of time, many scientists have challenged that once you get to a certain point, then the carbon dating is no longer an accurate way to calculate time. Okay, everything is a very big mystery.
Right.
But there's also an agenda. He alludes to this. So there's an agenda. And by the way, this book really very much follows his other book. The other book is The Missing 168 Years. In history, to reconcile the Churban Bayis Sheni, see, when you're going back, anything that's more recent is much easier to deal with than something like ancient Egypt. Ancient Egypt, you're dealing over here 4,000 years ago. You know, there's very little to work with. There's very little to work with. But you're dealing with something that was only 1,000 years ago. Oh, there's an enormous amount of information. So even what's more recent, there's a very big problem. There's a missing 168 years are missing. And our understanding of Jewish history is not synchronized with the secular understanding of history, period. And there's a 168 discrepancy. So he wrote a book. It's an extremely complicated book. It's very mathematical. And the side of the book, which comes into this book as well, and this book really is built upon that book, is that the Goyim deliberately, and this is an amazing chiddush to say, it's a shocking chiddush to say, and people don't want to hear this, but his proofs are just so rock solid, is that everything that happens in this world is all about us. And they deliberately manipulated the Goyim, this is Chiddush, deliberately manipulated the timeline of history to make believe that we don't exist. In recent times.
Well, ancient times too.
Oh, and from that, no, ancient times, let's take a step back. Ancient times, no one knows nothing. There are no real records. You're dealing with a few things etched in stone in hieroglyphics, and people make these gross assumptions, and everyone, yeah, and all of a sudden becomes Torah Sinai, and a lot of what they've done going further back is a cascade, all cascades from some blatant, deliberate manipulation of more recent history going back, let's say, 2,000 years ago. Which we know to be true. We know the Christians, they destroyed their own history because they don't want to be discovered. What a fraud! What exactly really happened? No one even knows what happened in the year zero. Okay, no one even knows what really went on then because they themselves, by their own admission, everything has been destroyed. There's been blatant manipulation. This is Chiddush of history. A lot of it has to do with us, in order to make believe that we don't exist. And once you've established a timeline, and then you have to go further back, which has been done more recently, the study of what took place in ancient times, that's a much more recent study. It all cascades from a mistake of a fraud that was done in more recent times. Okay, that's not the point we want to study. He goes through this whole thing, and again, what's important is you really need the background, which I don't have even a tipa shebiyam, the background to understand what I'm looking at and reading through over here and trying to break my head on, of the way ancient Egyptian history is taught to the world. And the way it's taught is this page that shows you 2,500 years of dynasties, and these numbers are sacred in the secular world. Dynasty 1, Dynasty 2, Dynasty 3, Dynasty 4 and 6. There's some that are very famous.
Well, what year was it? It's Mitzrayim.
What? Oh, that we're going to discuss in one moment. We're going to discuss that in a moment. And the Goyim, basically, they don't even deal with Yetzias Mitzrayim. They basically, the secular approach to studying history, they don't even want to even talk about it. And we, Jews, we take their secular history, and we try to figure out where in we accept this on the left side as fact, historical fact. And then we come along. The Goyim don't deal with Yetzias Mitzrayim. They couldn't care less. The Goyim could not care less about Yetzias Mitzrayim. In the secular world, in all of the colleges, and all of the archaeologists, it's not even on their mind. So how does Paro Melech Mitzrayim, it says in the Bible, Vayoka Melech Chodosh Elo Yoda Es Yosef, who is Yosef, it's not even an afterthought. They have established a timeline of ancient Egypt. They have universities, they have PhDs in this, they have postdoctorates, they have a whole institute for this. The Bible couldn't care less.
Right.
We from people will come along, accept everything that they say as fact, as the MS. This is what, why would they want to harm us? Why would they want to lie to us? And then we work backwards. And some people are more successful than others in trying to figure out where in this timeline, who is the Paro? Who is the Paro? Who is Yosef? Where is he? And people write things. Some things that people write are just total nonsense. And some things are interesting, and some things are theory. But at the end of the day, nothing really makes any sense. Nothing really makes any sense, period. Period. Because even this, the left side, is all based upon, oh, they found a stone somewhere, and someone chiseled, this was the king, and this was his viceroy, his visor. There's a visor, there's a king, and there's a visor, and...
Vizier.
Is this how you pronounce it? How you pronounce it?
Vizier.
See, I should keep my mouth shut.
Viceroy.
Better keep your mouth shut and let people think you're a fool than open it and remove all doubt. Okay? They have all these different whole cast of characters. And they put together from all over the country, from all over, they can find a piece of clay somewhere. Oh, look at this. This pot is like the pot they made in Canaan. Or this is a Syrian pot. Oh, a Syrian pot. It must be that this happened at this date. Excuse me, there was a tourist that came and left his canteen on the floor. They come to these outrageous conclusions. And since the truth is no one could care less, who cares anyway? So it makes a difference to anyone. So they just put it in the book. And before you blink, this becomes Torah Misinai. He came along. It cannot emphasize what a genius this person is. He wrote already many books. Each book is a life work, and he's a young guy. It's like Hashem gave us a genius to put the whole world back into order. It's like it's not normal what this person, what he wrote, how his mind works. A lot of it is very mathematical.
What's the name of the book again?
Pharaoh. You got to know the Yahya. Before you read the book, you got to spend History Channel. Learn Klor.
Well, I just read something and listened to a new show on Pharaohs.
Okay, so you gotta know the history. I don't know nothing, and also you have to know world history. He has come along and he has analyzed this with incredible understanding, and basically said everything that all these things that they found and they put this timeline and they accept to be sacred, it's all a bunch of baloney. It's all a bunch of garbage, mamish garbage. And he has shown that the correct timeline, using their terms, taking all of their tablets and monuments and stones and all the names etched, all of their evidence of the whole history, he has created a completely different timeline of ancient Egyptian history. And that's presented over here on the right side. And their history begins in the year 2000, approximately the year 2000 BC. You know when their history begins? It begins after the Mabul. Okay, it begins what, 300 years, 200 years after the Mabul?
Yeah.
And that's when we find on record the beginning of ancient Egypt. And the first three dynasties, it's correct. Even though there's almost nothing, by the way, when you read the book, the amount that we know about the first three dynasties is nearly nothing. It's just like almost.
The dynasty could have been 20 people in a family.
Right, exactly. It's almost nothing. Then what they claim took place in the ninth dynasty, okay, in the year that really happened, that what they claim happened using their numbers took place coincided with the third dynasty. What they claim happened in the 10th dynasty was right after, and then came what they call what they say took place in the 11th and 12th dynasty, which was later, happened after the third. He just totally changes the timeline. And he goes through this in very great detail, and then he presents, after he presents his timeline, he presents 60 proofs to show what he calls synchronizations. How after you go and you rewrite the timeline and you study everything else in Tanakh and even in secular world history, there are 60 events that perfectly coincide. Perfectly. And each one by itself is mind-boggling. And the evidence is just so compelling. Not that I know anything, who am I to say? He writes here in the Hakdama that he presented his thesis. He's going against the whole world. He's literally going against every college in the entire world by taking all of their evidence and presenting a completely different timeline and telling them Egypt didn't exist for 3,000 years. You made up 1,000 years that don't exist. Just don't exist. It's a big, big lie. It started approximately in the year 2000 after the Mabul. And from there, it goes on until Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Egypt. And he takes all and he rearranges with incredible proof all of what the dynasties that when they say it took place in a completely different order.
He took out 7, 8, and 14.
He didn't take anything out. He just replaced them in different locations.
No, they're not replaced. 7, 8, and 14.
Are not on this page?
Not replaced.
The middle.
No. and 14.
Okay, I don't know.
Yeah, but they were left, he eliminated them.
Could be Hill didn't exist. They didn't even exist. Or they're totally, some of the information of these things. Oh, okay. Now that's one thing to keep in mind. There's another very important thing to keep in mind, that which is very important. This is extremely relevant, and he brings shows to Chumash. I want to maybe spend do some of time do this. Is Egypt was not one major kingdom in the entire in their history. For a major chunk of their history, it was divided either into two parts or three parts. There was a Mill kingdom. There was a kingdom in the south and a kingdom in the north. It was not one communist state with one pharaoh that controlled the whole Egypt. There was the northern section of Egypt and the southern section of Egypt. And for a period of time, there was a middle kingdom. There were three different segments. I'm just giving you a nutshell, and you can see everything. I'm not making anything up over here in this book. There were three. And therefore, some of these dynasties that the Goyim present in a linear form, this happened after this, is total baloney. You're dealing with concurrent events. There was a pharaoh in the north, and there was I don't even know what the terms are. There was a king or a pharaoh in the north. And at the same time, there was a whole world of activity taking place in the south or in the middle kingdom. And when you piece everything together and you compare what was going on, what it says in Tanakh, and what it says, what we know about what was going on in the world, he shows 60 different synchronizations that fit like a glove after you rearrange. How did the Goyim come to this order? Because they found a stone here, and they did some carbon dating. Oh, so this stone is 200 years older than this stone.
Too much credit. Nobody knew anything about Egypt until 1812.
1812?
Yeah.
So there's certainly, it goes to show that this whole thing is baloney.
When Napoleon invaded Egypt, all of the scientists in those days came to Egypt. They found the Rosetta Stone. They started working on Egyptology. Before that, nobody
zero.
Cared about and nobody knew about
and you know what? No one cares about it today either.
These theories are built up
on lies.
From 200 years ago.
200 years ago. So certainly they made a mistake. 200, there's no Messiah on anything. So you go into a college today, this is the gold standard. It's not the gold standard. It doesn't make any sense. So he writes here in the Hagdamah that he presented his whole book to some of the biggest experts. Read this in the Hagdamah. He presented some of the biggest experts, and he basically said to them, "Your whole thing is a total lie. Look at my research." And they say, "They have nothing to say. There's no critique. You think, I'm waiting for a critique. You know, a critical. You just can't say something. You need a critique. I know zero. You want maybe someone will come over here and go and slug up the whole book. Gesunde hate. What do I know? I'm just telling you what he does over here." He says he presented his thesis to some of the biggest experts. And they just don't have anything to say.
Right.
Quiet. It's like on the news. You can show corruption in the government. Big deal. Biden, he's the Messiah. You can show if the Justice Department is corrupt. You can show a solid smoking gun evidence. I don't know what you're talking about. He presented his evidence to the world-renowned people who deal with this. I don't know what you're talking about. They're not interested. Now, what do you take out of this? Some of the synchronizations, there are some shocking things that could blow your mind. And I unfortunately don't have the vocabulary. I don't understand the archaeology. I don't understand anything. But some of the things he basically shows is that one of the main leaders of Paro, of Egypt, in the when Avraham Avinu came down to Egypt, the pharaoh, when Paro came down, when Avraham, there was a famine. It's a very important part of the story. Avraham came down, Hashem said, Lech lecha, me'aretzchem, v'latchem, be'savich lecha sha'areka, and he comes, and there's a famine, what am I going to do? So he goes to Egypt, and what happens? They take Sarah. Who took Sarah? So who's according to his new synchronization, if I'm mistaken, it was the son of Nimrod. Nimrod was a very big player. Nimrod was a very big player in the establishment of Egypt. And it was his son that played a very big role in meeting with Avram. And he shows psukim, he varfs, like you can't even imagine all these incredible things. There's a statue somewhere, a very strange statue somewhere in Egypt. He has all these, I don't know nothing, which has an image of a person on a chair, sitting on a chair. It's been destroyed mostly, with very interesting hair, wearing this very beautiful garment. And based on, scientific technology, they're able to read. So he claims, based on this whole story, that is a statue of Esav himself. Esav, it's incredible. Esav HaRasha. Esav HaRasha wearing the Bigdei Chamudos. And what he says is mamash compelling. You got to read what he says. You have to get someone in to critique the book. This is a statue. Esav came the day that was a very important event, when Avraham Avinu died, and Esav shows up. Esav on that day, he killed Nimrod. Nimrod was in the middle of building this incredible palace somewhere, and the moment that he died, they Esav commanded to board up the palace, to bury Nimrod in the garden outside, and to erect a statue showing, I'm the one that killed him. And then Nimrod's descendants, they broke in years later into his coffin to take away his body, to take back his body. I can't tell you this, but I want to bring up some certain points. He shows is that Egypt, at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, the other piece of paper that I have is the time that according to his new timeline, again, there are two papers. On the other paper, I can't pronounce these names. The last one on the page, the younger, I don't know how to pronounce this name, he was the king. He was the king of the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim.
How do you spell it?
N-E-F, on this second page. Nepakari the younger, was the paro of Parshas Shemos, Vayomos Melech, the one that died was Pipi, is that how you pronounce it?
Pepi
the second, when it says Vayomos Melech, last week's parsha, Vayomos Melech Mitzrayim, Vayonchu Vine Yisrael Menhu Avodah, who died? Pepi the second died. He lived for 94 years. And he was very,
The reign was 94 years.
He lived a very long time. And he wasn't so good. I'm getting confused. Okay, he spells it out in utter detail. Which pyro did Yosef meet? According to his new timeline, and everything stims, all he has to prove, everything fits like a glove. He shows you exactly which pyro Yaakov met with a pyro. Avraham, when he went down to Egypt, there was a famine there with the pyro. At the time, who was the pyro of Yetzias Mitzrayim? He goes through everything in very great detail, but he also shows that basically that the entire story, the part of Egypt that enslaved the Jewish people was the northern Egypt. It was the northern part of the country. There were basically two countries. There was the northern part and the southern part. The northern part is where the Paro of Mitzrayim lived. He controlled, they tortured the Jewish people, but there was a southern section, which it's not exactly clear.
Well, if you look at the old maps, the map of Egypt was way larger than it is today. It was all of Sudan and half of Ethiopia, what you have today. But both of the Nile.
The Oroif, they deal with all these things. And he basically says every time it says, and sometimes it says Mitzrayim, and sometimes it says in Chumash Eretz Mitzrayim. Wherever it says Mitzrayim, it's referring to the northern part, where the Paro had full control. Wherever it says Eretz Mitzrayim, it's referring to the south. And he goes through all the Makos to show you, Moshe, for example, it says that there was blood. Maybe we'll do one or two psukim before time runs out. Let's give you one or two psukim to show you the difference between the northern portion and the southern portion.
By the way, the Bell of the Scribe is the one who went to Nineveh, right? So he became a...
Okay, that's afterwards. Okay, that's a later period, right? That's a later period.
Yeah, but
for example,
he didn't die then. He continued many years later.
Okay, but even before you go further, before you give you some examples of this, is another very critical thing to appreciate, and that is the leader of the northern part of Paro was not a native. He was a foreigner, and he suggests with very fascinating suggests he was really someone from the Edom. He was really a descendant of Esav. He came down at the time. When the Jewish people were there, and there was a war. And he, I take that back. Not a war. He married into the family. It was a mixed marriage. He was not a native to Egypt. He was a descendant of Esav, and he married into the Egyptian dynasty, royal family. And then when the king died, the Edom, the son-in-law, who was not a native of the land, he took over. And he explains, that's why it says, it calls in Shiras Hayam, Omar Oyev, Erdoif Asik Achalek Shalol, the Oyev. The only one in Tanakh that's called the Oyev is Esav. So he suggests, and he has another pasuk, he suggests is that Egypt was really a combination of Egypt and Esav. And he explains that's why it's called 400 years, because it was 200 years we were in Egypt, and we were in Egypt for 200 years because it was also under Esav's control. It was a mixed marriage. It counted double years. That's a little bit of a chiddush to say that. But he explains, I don't remember, and it's too complicated for my little head to put all the pieces together, but he explains, it's a tremendous chiddush. But he says, he quotes Pesukim right and left and answers all these very difficult questions. Mefarshim have these very difficult questions. And he says, now that you know the history, now that you know the correct timeline, and you know that there was an invasion by Esav into the northern part, when Esav came, he was not able to take over the whole country. They didn't want him to go take over the whole country because he was not a native to the land. But he was very powerful. So this descendant conquered only the northern section. And the southern section he did not have full control over. And there were Jews living in the north, living in the south. If you lived in the north, it was a communist state. You couldn't move. And they had total control over you. In the south, you also, there was sympathy. Anti-Semitism has a lot of friends. Goshen is in the north. I think it's in the north. Goshen was in the north, if I'm not mistaken. Pison Ramses was for sure in the north. Maybe not. Maybe Goshen was in the south. I don't know. He talks about it. Pison and Ramses were for sure in the north. For sure.
They were definitely in the north.
And there was an invasion. And that's why Vayakam Melech Chodosh. Why is he called Melech Chodosh? You don't call a king because this king did not
this
belong here.
This is very good history. This a lot of this fits in with the Sefer Yosho that writes down all these things. I mean, I didn't want to, it's too crazy to repeat what's in that Sefer, but it gives a whole history of what happened in those 210 years that the Jews were in Mitzrayim. Backstory on those 210 years, what was going on in the world. And it was a lot of wars between Esav and Yishmael invading Egypt.
We take out of this is that the timeline that the Goyim present us is clearly not correct. He has a different timeline that reduces their history to about 2,000 years. The king of Paro at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim was not a native to Egypt. He was married into the family, and he maneuvered himself to take off very similar to Achashverosh. Achashverosh was a stable boy. He had no business being the king. He married into the family. He killed everyone, whatever he did. And the Paro of Egypt was really a member of Edom. He explains that's why there are two nations that you're not allowed to marry for three generations. An Egyptian and an Edom. Ador Shlishi. Why only a descendant of Edom and a descendant of Mitzrayim you are not allowed to marry for three generations? Why? What about Ammon and Moab And why? The answer is because Klal Yisrael, when they were in Mitzrayim, Mitzrayim was a complex shibud. It was a shibud of three generations, okay, with the Dor Revihi Yoshuvu Hena. We were there for three generations, subjugated by a king who was from Edom, married to a woman who was from a native to the dynasty of Egypt. It was a combination of Edom and Mitzrayim. And why, when we left, it says that Edom, I can't remember all the psukim. He has a lot of different ideas. Let us give you one example about Dam. He goes through all the ten makos. It's fascinating. All the ten makos, read them very carefully. Some of the makos, it says there was a mako in Mitzrayim, and some it says there was a mako in Eretz Mitzrayim. Some it says both. So I'll just give you over here for example. When it comes to, let's say, makas, he goes through all the makos, I thought, over here. Mak of Dam. Okay, Mak of Dam, it says that the waters of there was the Moshe hit the Mayim of Mitzrayim. But then, and then it says that there was blood in all of Eretz Mitzrayim, Right. So he explains to me means is the water flows from the north to the south.
Right.
Only the water in the northern regime, in the northern Malchus, was smitten. But because the south got all their water from the north, the water flowed down and contaminated. It goes from the south to the north? The verse relates that the waters of Egypt, I'll read you what it says over here. Okay, let's do one example. The verse relates, I'll read you what he says. If it's wrong, listen, I don't know anything. The verse relates that the waters of Egypt were smitten. Egypt could not drink from the Nile, and Egypt had to dig around the Nile for water. Yet it also states that the blood was all over the land of Egypt. This can now be understood to mean that only the waters of the northern kingdom were smitten. The section of the Nile flowing down from the south, in the northern kingdom, The section of the Nile flowing down from the south in the northern kingdom domain. The rest of, so the southern part of the north, it's a little confusing, which means the north, let's see. The rest of Egypt had water from the upper part of the Nile. But the blood from the northern kingdom evaporated into clouds and fell over the whole. Some of these things are a little bit vague how he explains it. Okay, another example. Let's talk about, there's an old age-old question of how...
4,300 miles long.
Okay, you have to go through every example and study yourself. You don't agree, I'm not telling you everything makes sense. I'm just telling you it's interesting. These are new things over here before. Okay, now another example. It says there's an age-old question. Hayore Borot. Hayore Devar Hashem Heinis. Whoever was Yore Devar Hashem, they brought their animals inside not to be smitten by the Borot. All the commentators asked the question, where did they have animals to die by Borot when all the animals died by Dever? Dever, there was a plague. There was a plague. Every animal was dead. So all the animals died by Dever. Where were their animals? So he says, if you look in the Pasuk, it says that the animals that died were only the animals in Mitzrayim. And the animals that they took inside to protect was, let me read the words. In Exodus, the verse relates to the plague of the boils, plague of hailstones affected the Egyptian livestock.
Yeah, because they asked the question, how did they get all these chariots and horses to chase the B'nai?
Oh, that's another question. However, a close look at the verses reveals that in reference to all the plagues, the land of Egypt is used, except for one. The only place that it does not say the land, that was the Makos affected both regions. The north and the south, they all hated us. The primary shibud was in the north, but there was suffering in the south as well. Every single market says the words Eretz Mitzrayim. The only time it does not say Eretz Mitzrayim is by the market of Dever. Pestilence, where the term used is simply Egypt. Indeed, all the livestock of Egypt, the northern kingdom, died. But there remained livestock in the rest of Egypt, and those were the ones that were affected by the plague of boils and hailstones. The question was, how did they have animals left to die, to suffer from Shechin and from Barot, when the pasuk explicitly says that all of the animals died in Dever? The answer is, by Dever, it says the only animals that died were the animals of Mitzrayim. And in fact, it is the only one of the 10 Makos where it only uses the term Mitzrayim and does not use the term Eretz Mitzrayim. So that means there's two different lands. There's a land of Mitzrayim and the land of Eretz Mitzrayim. The biggest drush, this is a drush of them all, we'll have to tell over here, the biggest drush of them all is, he says that you look at matzah, what do you do on Pesach? Pesach, matzah, morar. Kol mi shloi amas shloisha dvarim eil lo yotso yidei chayvaseh ve'eilu hein, Pesach, matzah, and morar. By Pesach, it only says the term Mitzrayim. Matzah, it says Eretz Mitzrayim. There are two dimensions to Yitzias Mitzrayim. There is an element of leaving Mitzrayim, and there was an element in leaving Eretz Mitzrayim. We just put everything together and one size fits all. It was a very complicated country, and we suffered. There were different dimensions of suffering. There was an element of suffering that came from the northern regime, the northern kingdom, that was unique, and that's Mitzrayim. And there was another element of suffering that came from the southern portion of Egypt, which it's not clear how it was structured. What control did Paro have over the south? The south seems to have their own independent governance. But yet, it's clear as day that Paro had an incredible influence and power over the south as well. What was it, like a federal and state government? Was there some type of shared? But there's no. He shows here that there were two different dimensions to our Shibut. There was a dimension of our Shibut that was from the north, and there was a dimension of the Shibut that was from the south. The north was controlled by a person who he claims, with many, many powerful proofs, was a foreigner, wasn't a native to Egypt, had blood of the Esav, Harasha, in him, and he was coming to take revenge. The descendants of Esav were coming to take revenge for Yaakov Avinu, for stealing the Bechorah. And in the south, it appears it was free. There was less control of Esav. It was more a pure Egyptian type of Shibud. There are two different Shibudim that are happening concurrently. It's a very fascinating history. There's a lot more Chidushim, and maybe we'll do some of the Chidushim another time. But I didn't even scratch the surface of understanding what he said. Certainly to give over. And I encourage you to take a look at this.
I will.
But I warn you, you can keep it. I warn you, if you want, I'll take it back. I'll put it away, but if you want, you can have it. But I warn you, you really, really need to know in advance. Try to go on YouTube and view some videos of ancient Egyptian history. Ancient Egyptian history to get some background, and then when you start reading this, it'll blow your mind.
Amen.